here with Emma Forrest, who is most recently the author of Your Voice in My Head. Emma, your voice is not in my head, but is my voice in your head? How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm just off a plane from LA, and then I'm just on a plane to LA again. Ah. I'm just reading tonight at Book Court, and here to speak to you, and then I'm going home.
Oh, okay.
So I'm a little exhausted, but that can lead to positive mania, maybe.
Yes.
Ah, let's see.
Well, Ben Yagoda wrote a book a couple of years ago, and he suggested, as obviously triggering various fire alarms.
That's the memoir police coming to get me.
Yes, the memoir police. That the memoir has become the central form of our culture, that to hell with fiction and the like.
Yeah.
I'm curious if your work can be likened to a culture of its own. Is it safe to say that Your Voice in My Head is the central form of your oeuvre?
I would definitely say it was a breakthrough for me. It's my strongest piece of writing, for sure. My editor in England at Bloomsbury, who's published all of my books, and there were three novels before this, says that in retrospect she understands that the novels were all a dress rehearsal for this.
Yeah.
Because they're almost the story here, but not quite. I was holding back. So this is a one-off. I don't plan to write more memoir. I'm now writing another novel.
Yeah.
But it had to come out because it was blocking me artistically from, I couldn't finish the next book, I couldn't finish the next script. And this has set me free and improved my writing in every way possible.
Why didn't fiction cut the mustard in terms of being liberated? A lot of novelists talk with are able to go ahead and write whatever the hell they want and unleash all sorts of demons.
I don't want to sound like I'm whinging, but partly there are troublesome aspects of being a very young female novelist that you don't come up against when you write memoir as a woman, which is knowing in advance that if you're not Zadie Smith and you're not Jackie Collins, they really don't know what to do except say that you're chick lit no matter what you write. I mean, one of my favorite New York authors when I moved here was Jennifer Bell, who wrote Going Down, which is a great book and sort of, you know, on a par with the best of Jay McInerney, but someone who was pitched insanely as chick lit, which it's just not. And so that was a struggle for me and a painful one, and I think I was so hung up on that really hindered me. Whereas with memoir, in many, many ways, you're much freer. You don't have those constraints. They understand that you can go dark, you can go gritty. But there has been this whole thing. There's the next label of misery memoir. I don't know if that's also an American term, but certainly in England, you know, that's a whole new thing. And I think another way of saying women's voices don't really count, you know, because when men write memoirs about breakdown or addiction, it's like they're so brave, and when women do it, there is this feeling of like, God, they're narcissists.
Yeah,
there does seem to be a double standard.
And if you're David Carr or Bill Clegg, you get a lot more money too,
right? Probably. I'm sure.
Well, so you're saying that a young novelist has to bear her soul in an extremely introspective, painful way in order to actually matter and transcend the chick lit label?
I was bearing my soul, but they were labeling it something it wasn't.
Yeah.
And
that's
ridiculous.
Yeah.
So stepping it up a level and saying this is the truth brought it to a new audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are numerous points in this book where you speculate on Dr. R's judgment.
Yeah.
Dr. R, psychotherapist, he dies.
Yeah.
And this book depicts you coming to terms with that, just to sort of fill it in for listeners who may not know. You're speculating on his judgment, his impression of you, even after his death. You write, "I try to think how Dr. R would feel about me walking the red carpet." You note that during the 8 years you served as his patient, he came to your book readings, didn't approach you because of doctor-patient guidelines.
Yeah.
Do you believe that Dr. R completely and totally cared about you? Because it is interesting to me, reading this book, how you're latching on to someone who is not 100% personal, but who actually has to offer it in a professional capacity.
That's why psychotherapy works, in my opinion, is that you're never going to see them across the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, now that I have a new therapist, and I had tried a few before I settled on a new one, I realized how very non-prescriptive he was, actually, in fact. Like, the people I've seen since are much more active in their advice and in their decision making suggestive on my behalf. I think I just liked him, and I liked how he saw me. And I didn't like myself when I met him at all. So I suppose that could have happened outside. That could, do you know what? If I had gotten lucky, that could have happened in a romantic relationship, that you meet someone that you think so highly of that just the mere fact that they think you're a good person makes you like yourself again. It just so happened, I suppose, that it was in this doctor-patient relationship that someone who I just admired and genuinely liked so much liked me back.
But I'm curious if you want to know ever felt that he attended your readings out of a professional duty the same way that you often have agents and publicists attend.
I've never had any other therapist do that. I think he was a mensch. I think it's that simple.
No doubts or no understanding that this is a professional guy?
Yes, complete understanding, absolutely. But I think the reason he was so successful at what he did and did save so many people, and you know that, as you know, there's testament throughout the book from other people who say, literally, he saved my life, is that he was just a good guy. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of good therapists and psychiatrists who are bloody brilliant and good at what they do and who aren't nice. I mean, I met them.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a good guy.
You write, "I always see Monica Lewinsky when I'm crying in West Village cafes." Monica is no hallucination in your mind, you point out. You equate her with Chandra Levy, a victim of fucking and lust and love instead of murder.
Yeah.
Irrespective of your own association with celebrities, which we'll get to in a minute.
Right.
Why are your examples of victimhood so closely aligned with celebrity culture? Does learning how to survive...
No, do you know what they were? They, to me, actually, growing up in England, you have to understand there's such a minuscule Jewish community that what they set off in me actually was prominent young Jewish women, because you didn't have those figures in England. So that's what Chandra Levy and Monica Lewinsky were about. For me.
Any prominent young Jewish woman would be a sort of person to reach out to from
a
comparative standpoint.
Well, they were in the press every day for reasons of longing and misery. And I was Jewish and felt longing and misery. So that's why I reached out to them.
But why not real, tangible people who aren't in the headlines? Didn't know anybody? You could have talked to somebody.
I was the only Jew at my school.
Huh. Nobody?
Nobody.
You could have talked to anybody? You couldn't talk to anybody in the street or anything?
That would have been even weirder, dude. Go out to someone in the street.
Talk to someone in the cafe, in a bar, or anything, or in a park, go for a
walk. It was specifically about Jewishness for me. Yeah. That, you know, I was without identity, I was looking for an identity, that was the most tangible one for me, I saw it, I grasped for it, perverse as it may seem, but that's what they were for me.
And victimhood naturally came about from a Jewish comparative standpoint.
Yes.
Huh. The Gypsy Husbands fan community.
Yes. Favorite.
Called you fat and ugly. Some went into serious hate. You write, "I found myself longing for the days of good old-fashioned handwritten anti-Semitism." Why were you paying attention to this? You also write, "Because some part of me, even after all of Dr. R's work, still doesn't know which voices are real or not." Why wasn't the other part of you strong enough to make this distinction?
Because I think it was an unhealthy relationship for me. Because I think that as much as I liked him and he liked me, I am or was by nature quite a fragile person, and being in that sort of fishbowl was not mentally healthy for me. It wouldn't be bad for other personality types, for someone stronger, for someone tougher, but I'm not that tough. And I paid attention to those voices because it was a descent again into a kind of self-harm. And I no longer, it had been years and years since I did actually cut myself, which had been my thing. And this was a way to substitute. And it was self-harm to go again and again to the internet where you know people are saying you're repulsive and to look at that, you know, every single day.
But surely there's some part of you who's going to recognize, hey, these folks are crackpots.
Oh, I knew that all the time. And yet, you know, I wasn't in a good place. And the worse it got for me, the more I sought it out.
Yeah. You were addicted to the idea of being ridiculed like this?
Well, it's a kind of narcissism, isn't it? It's the flip side of looking for that self-loathing, as it is self-obsession. Self-disgust is self-obsession, isn't it?
But why this mirror on the internet as opposed to just saying, oh,
an addict-y quality, I think. I mean, Dr. R had actually told me before he died that the psychiatric Bible or whatever it is had to recently redefine addiction to include the internet, because it had so commonly become the place for addicts or former addicts to go to lose themselves. And I've been addicted to cutting, and when I really got into the internet, it did replace it, just because of the ugliness accessible at a moment's stroke, like a razor.
Cutting and the internet, define this association. How did it work?
Instant gratification, that's all. I mean, like, say you were anorexic, it would take a long time, probably at least 3 months, before anyone noticed and before you started to look the way you felt inside, which is ugly. Whereas cutting and the internet are instant. If you want to feel pain right away, you can do it at the stroke of a knife or the stroke of a keyboard.
Yeah. So the keyboard was a knife?
Absolutely.
Huh. Interesting. You said in an interview with The All that much of this book ended up on your screen by osmosis, that there was material here that you don't even remember typing.
Yeah.
If you're caught in a fugue state when you're writing something like this, at what point do the words mean something? And at some point, you're going to have to look at these words and come to terms with them and I suppose, iron them out. And so I'm curious how you became more aware of yourself, your life experience, and the world if you weren't aware of it initially.
Well, you may have also read that I had this whole deal with myself that I didn't have to publish it. Just because I was writing it didn't mean I had to publish it. And when it was done, I did think it was good enough to publish. And I probably, you know, I read it all the times I had to edit it. But actually, so I handed it in a year and a half ago. It takes a while for a book to come out. Now that it's out and I've been touring, this sounds awful, but I'm going to admit it. I've been rereading the book quite often and actually enjoying it. And I think getting out of it what you're talking about for the first time, it's taken a year and a half to get into it and say, oh, that's what you're about and that's what you're doing wrong. And now I get it and now I get the lessons. And because it is trapped between the pages, it's safe for me to explore almost with a eagle eye from above. You know what I mean? Like looking down on myself.
On the other hand, I mean, most writers, even writers of memoirs, get sick of looking at their own words.
Well,
why is it such a great...
Well, because I didn't, you know, I looked at it the bare minimum when I was editing. You know, and we did a very light edit, actually. I find it fascinating now because I feel so removed from it. It's almost like I'm intrigued and empathetic towards this girl that isn't me anymore. It's harder on the reader because it reads so viscerally.
Yeah.
I'm comforting readers all the time saying, I'm not her. I really am not that person anymore. Don't worry about me.
Well, we are all some part of our past lives.
But do you remember the part in the book, the rabbi's sermon about, you know, transformation and you don't have to be Jacob anymore. You are now Israel. And parts of Jacob will cling to you for the rest of your life.
Yes.
But that isn't the entirety of who you are. That's where I feel I am.
But you're saying transformation. I mean, describe this more specifically. How do you deal with these parts of who you inevitably are? I mean, is it really just a matter of rereading and is that your reminder? Or isn't your memory of it enough? You know what
memory
I mean?
Memory's dangerous, you know. It's hard to have volume control on memory. Writing it down was my volume control. And that's what made it safe. And that's what, I'm going to use the cheapest pop cultural allegory. It's really in my head, like the villains in Superman 2 when they're trapped. Is it 2 that they're trapped in glass and they're flying through space
Actually,
and time?
Technically 1 and 2.
1 and 2.
But 2
flying
they,
through
they
space
broke,
and time
yeah.
for all eternity.
Yeah.
My memoir is Terrence Stamp beneath the glass, trapped. And so that's why it's all safe for me now and done.
Well, I don't know if General
and it
Zod
flies
is the best.
Through, it flies through space and time because it's a book that hopefully will stay in publication.
You're using General Zod as a metaphor.
Totally.
Now this is dangerous because, of course, he wanted to be the planet, you know, he wanted to be the ruler of the planet.
Right.
He asked people to kneel before Zod.
Yeah.
I'm certainly not going to kneel before Emma.
Right.
And I don't know if the reader is going to do that, but the reader may empathize.
Some of them are.
Some of
them are. They're awesome, too.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're seriously, why not someone, I suppose,
because
more humbler
I
than
think
General
there
Zod?
There are things in there that are evil and upsetting, just like General Zod. Come on, we have to get off this. Awful things that are now trapped and safe and I don't have to worry about.
Okay. Library Journal's Julie Kane wrote, I will be highly annoyed if this is marketed as the Colin Farrell story.
I think he will too.
Yeah. The obvious question, why refer to Colin Farrell as your gypsy husband? Why not just be transparent about Colin's name? I mean...
People in the book who have pseudonyms, which is my doctor and the lover, were people I was not able to write their name down as I was writing it. It was too evocative and too painful for me to write their names.
Even though you don't really remember writing that chunk of the memoir.
I remember that part. So, you know, as much as to a degree it was about protection for them, it was also about protection for me, because people ask, are there any boundaries to memoir? And yes, actually there are. And that was my boundary to keep me safe.
Did you readjust anything during the editing process? Was a memory not precise or not clear enough, or perhaps...
All the people in the book who are still in my life, who are pseudonyms, but who will know that it's them when they read it, you know, I contacted them all and said, do you want to read this and make changes? And my friend, who's the playwright in the book, said, you've remembered this completely wrong. This is not what happened at all. Here's how it went down. And I wrote back, because he's one of my best friends, mortified. Jesus, thank God you told me in time, I'm going to change that. And he wrote back, you're a fucking writer. Can I swear?
Yeah, you can say fuck.
Fucking writer. Stand up for yourself. Don't be a pussy. You have to keep it how you wrote it. And I was like, oh, okay. So I did. That should have changed if he's right and I was wrong. But he thought it was more important to keep it as I remembered it than as he felt was true.
Were there quibbles with friends over the absolutes?
No, my mom hates the word pussy. So that was in the book. And she asked me to specifically to take that word out. And I did. And that meant I think I got a lot of other stuff through that I wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah.
So I did that for her. My grandma really curses and says bad words, and they were in there, and my dad asked me to take those words out, which I did. But that's all they asked me to change.
You won't write about anybody ever again?
Of course I will, but maybe through the prism of screenwriting or novels. But I don't need to write about me again for a bloody long time.
Midway through the book, and I'm going to try to be as delicate with this as I can, you describe an incident after you met a woman at a breeder's show.
Yeah.
This woman argued with her husband. You hid under the blankets.
Yeah.
This guy, he had seen photographs of you in a bikini.
Yeah.
He took you into an alley, and there's no way of softening it.
Well, some people think it was rape, and some people don't. It's interesting.
Because I view it as rape.
Yeah.
Because you said no, I think it's rape.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because that part was excerpted in The Guardian, and the way I describe it, I say to Dr. R that I was so upset because it was my first time, and if I had been, you know, he said if I had been having sex for a decade or something, it wouldn't be so, it wouldn't hover in my mind so heavily, it would have just been a horrible incident. And readers did write in and say that absolutely was rape, and he was wrong not to say that. I think what he didn't want to happen, what he never wanted to happen, he knew I was susceptible to clinging to labels. Like, he knew that if he said, you are a rape victim, that's what I would become, you know, for the rest of my life. That's why he didn't like to get, people always really want to know the specifics of what exactly were you diagnosed with. And he didn't like diagnoses because he felt people cling to them and don't get better, you know? But I have to say, that segment of the book that you mentioned, there's an audio, I've done an audio tape of the whole book. And when they asked me to do it, I said, oh, look, I can get you a great actress. And they said, no, it's memoir, so we always have the author do it. And I was shocked. That was the one part of the book I did. I lost it in the booth, you know, with a sound engineer who I had never met before. And it shocked me. Because I think Dr. R was very successful in keeping it from being that present in my mind. But the sad thing is, I think almost every girl you'll speak to has that experience. And in fact, on the spectrum, I got off really lightly.
Yeah, yeah. But it also suggests to me another common theme in the book, which is, you know, you have these people and you have yourself constantly judging your body.
Right.
The cutting, which we had alluded to earlier. This guy named Simon who...
Oh, my God.
He doesn't want you to swim because other men might see your body.
Yeah.
You take Simon in to see Dr. R. He says, I think you've misunderstood me. You have stretch marks on your arse and your tits sag. Yeah. What I meant was that your body is perfect to me. Yes. And then later in the book, you describe looking out your New York apartment window and seeking out places to fall. Specifically, the question you ask is, where would my body land?
Yeah.
It seems to me, just as a reader, I only just met you,
yes,
that some of these problems relate very much to body image. Have you reached a point you say you're transformed.
Yeah.
You know, do you accept your body now?
Yeah,
you...
absolutely. I think a lot of it, everything got so much better from, really a lot better from 30, but better each year from 26, 27, 28, each year was better. And in your 30s, I think if you're healthy, you just don't care, because that obsession with body, for women, the most dangerous thing about it is that it's a form of procrastination. It really is. And when I stopped being hung up on that, I got a lot more work done. And the more work, and you know, it's a figure eight. The more work I got done, the less I care about how I look. And the more good work I got done, the less I care about how I look. And yeah, that's my answer.
You alluded to this incident with the audio engineer where you broke down.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the act of writing doesn't entirely exercise the ghost, and yet, you know, you claim yourself transformed.
Yeah.
What of this idea of writing as exorcism here? Do you feel that you've fully exercised, so to speak?
I do, but again, you know, to come back to this thing I told you, I do think writing can be an exorcism. I don't think that's necessarily a good reason to publish. And that's why I was very strict about putting it in a drawer if it was no good. And my agents and my editors have always been, you know, really, as I had said to you, there was a novel I couldn't finish, and they had just said, this is bad. This is not your good work. So they've been very honest with me. So I trusted them when they said, this is your best work.
Yeah.
It was an exorcism for me, but that's not enough.
On the other hand, why bother to publish at all? Why not keep this to yourself?
Do you know why? Because I'm a writer. That's what we do. We publish our writing. That's the only answer.
Opening yourself to further personal criticism from...
Yes, but now I have the power to disconnect from that.
Okay. You write that you have the luxury to find inspiration in the pain because I am a middle-class girl with a tight-knit family.
Yeah.
What does class or one station
life
have
to do with it? Well, you're talking to an English girl. Come on. I mean, it's in the fabric of our being in England.
Yeah.
It's very much to do with the immigrant story in England as well. You know, that my father was sent to a boarding school from the age of 4 to learn to become British so that he would not seem Jewish, you know, by Russians. And when I used to write for the Jewish Chronicle, if I ever criticized the royal family, I would get the craziest letters from readers saying, you're lucky enough to be in a country that's letting us live here. Don't ever criticize the royals.
Yeah.
Classes, like, come on, we live and breathe it there.
Yeah. So it seems to me that your Jewish identity, your British identity,
Well, being a British Jew is very different from being an American Jew.
Or even, like, you know, I've talked with, you know, Howard Jacobson and Mike Lee, Manchester Jews.
Oh, my God.
And you want to talk about guys who really are...
And I got to hang out with Howard at the Sydney Writers' Festival, and we did talk about this.
Oh, he's a lot of fun, but he's very opinionated man.
Yeah, he's wonderful. Yeah. He's a wonderful man. But, yes, it was huge culture shock when I moved to New York and realized that I was, by my religion, in the majority rather than the minority.
Yeah.
And it had been something that had marked me out so much at school. A mark, you know. And that's why people have written about this a lot. Why the
you people?
No, I said people have written about this a lot. This, that Superman was created by two Jewish kids and is the only superhero who doesn't have to cover his face to quote-unquote pass. He just has to behave differently.
Yeah.
And that's the story of the Jews.
Yeah. When you were seen weeping in grief over the loss of your therapist at Shabbat, your rabbi tells you love is extremely serious. I don't think this is trivial.
Yeah.
Did you reach a point in writing this book where you were able to distinguish between the serious and the trivial?
I think so. I mean, I know some of it's ridiculous, and hopefully there's humor in the ridiculous parts. I mean, I know the parts that are just silly. I do think I'm able to distinguish. I think sometimes critics are not able to distinguish, and I think sometimes they are not attuned to the humor that was the final layer of the book. I mean, that's something I learned in screenwriting, is no matter how dark the subject matter is, where are 12 places to put jokes, you know? That's always the last draft for me.
You describe how you were emotionally moved by this rabbi's sermon, which we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Words from other people proved to be a method of dealing with what you describe as the 31 flavors of pain.
Yeah.
You were telling me that you're still reading the book. To what degree are the words that you committed to this book that of another person? Just to sort of... what degree are the words that you committed to this book that of another person? Transformation is one thing.
Right.
But
you are connected to that person. Do you mean in almost sort of a disassociative way? Like my words?
Yeah.
What they mean to me?
Are they that of another person entirely?
No, I'm not that disassociative. I used to be, but no. No, I know it's me. Yeah. I mean, I think his passage is amazing, and that was a risk, printing an entire sermon by a rabbi, you know, who none of the readers will know, although actually he's quite well known. But yeah, that's a sermon that changed my life, and I don't believe in God, and he knows that I don't believe in God.
Yeah.
And that's still a sermon that changed my life and kept me afloat when I so easily could have gone under.
Do you still require words to change your life?
Yeah. Usually it's songs, you know, but yeah.
What was the last set of words that changed your life?
On the subway. I don't know if it changed my life, but it certainly captured my mood. Just now, God, I love being on the New York City subway. I was on the 6 train listening to Tender by Blur, and it has the refrain, "Tender is the day the demons go away. Love's the greatest thing." And look, I actually left my medication in LA, so it could be that I'm just on a manic swing, but I just feel really, really, really up and really good. And songs, I do come back to them again and again, more than novels actually, because I love writing that's spare, and that's what great songwriters have to do, is say exactly what they mean in as few words as possible. That's why I talk about Leonard Cohen so much, and Paul Simon and Springsteen and Joni Mitchell, who says that Blue was really just a nervous breakdown on record, you know, before people talked about nervous breakdowns.
Well, on that note, Emma, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting
with you. Thank you.
All right.